So we're on week four of this course, Becoming Your Best Self. A warm welcome to those of you first time back since pre-COVID, first time here ever, really warm hello. And also a hello to our online students as well. So nice that you could join us. So I do my best to keep my concentration on everything. Hopefully it'll work out. So I'm the program coordinator here, and I've also been at Langley Temple Center for about 24 years. And I was brought up a Buddhist, but doesn't necessarily mean that I was a good Buddhist. And so a lot of what we go through in these classes in particular is drawn from my own difficulties of trying to actually integrate Buddhism into daily life, trying to make it your own, make it authentic. So this course in particular, it's going to be relevant whether you're Buddhist or not. It's going to make sense. Oh dear. So T. Pollard, no, I'm not on mute, and I'm not sure. You might have to use some headphones. I'm not sure how to deal with that audio problem. So we have our screen share. Whoops, wrong button. And what I thought we could do was just go through what we've covered so far, just to jolt your memories, those of you who have been here since the beginning. So the first class, we looked at what is happiness, because we all want happiness, and yet it's so elusive. So we talked about the different types of happiness or the different levels of happiness. Does anyone remember what they were? Just randomly in your own words, that's fine. Yeah. Yep, lower, middling, and the highest form, that's right.
Getting, giving, and becoming.
Aha, the happiness from getting, giving, and becoming. Anyone give me an example of the happiness from getting? Cheesecake, my favourite, until it's not. You kind of get the drift, don't you? The happiness from giving. What's an example of that?
Helping
the community. Yep. And the happiness of becoming. We had, yeah, working on yourself, inspiration. One of the examples that we used was the kind of happiness that that comes from within, that isn't circumstantial, and that can't really be lost. So, for instance, once we learn to read, we don't have to learn again each year. We know how to read. So that's like something that we've had the realization of. It's become part of us. So the kind of happiness, courage, equanimity that comes from within, that we develop within our own mind. So the happiness from the senses, the happiness that comes from deep concentration and from giving, hello, welcome, and the happiness from within. And then we also had a look at then what distracts us from happiness, or what corrupts all of our good intentions. And they came under a list of the eight worldly concerns. Does anyone remember any of those? What are the things that we get concerned about, or we get overwhelmed with, that kind of tunnel vision our experience? Catherine, you know these. Come on, name me one. Yeah, that's it. They come in pairs, and praise and blame, seeking praise, always being very happy about praise and flattery, hating being criticized, blame, always seeking to avoid it. Any other pairs of opposites anyone can remember? Pleasure and pain, seeking pleasure, trying to avoid pain. So where does that go wrong? Anyone think of an example? The one, if we seek to avoid pain and we're terrified of going to the dentist, and we put it off and we put it off and we put it off until it's just really bad, things get worse, isn't it? That's right. Yeah, so there was a few. There was seeking pleasure, avoiding pain, just those immediate short-term ones. And the seeking pleasure, like I love blobbing out on the couch, but long-term wise, that's no good for fitness, is it? Seeking always gain and profit, trying to avoid any form of loss. So we throw, you know, good money after bad. Praise and blame, and success and failure. And remember, that's a really big one too. If we're held back by our fear of failure. You know, so many things that we could be doing and loving doing and contributing to the world, but just through this fear of failure, we stop ourselves. And a part of that also was ascribing success at doing things as whether we're a good human being or not. So if we're not successful, then somehow we take it personally and feel that we're not worthwhile as a human being. And then we've also looked at the three higher trainings with this wonderful analogy of cutting suffering at the root. So instead of just picking off all the leaves of the tree one by one, dealing with all of our problems one by one, which could take a very, very long time, in one swoop, severing the root of all of our problems. So does anyone remember what the three higher trainings are? It's a little bit of a dry list, but come on.
Ethics.
And which bit of the picture represents ethics? Anybody know? Anyone who was here last week? Okie dokie. So the three higher trainings, ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So ethics is the body, the strong body. So we have to embody our ethics, don't we? We can't just pay lip service to it. It's our core strength. Our ethics are our core strength. Concentration are the two arms that hold the axe of wisdom that severs the root of suffering. So if we have that axe but we have no concentration, we have all of these intellectual smarts, but all of our study, it might backfire on us. We might just get more cynical or more kind of desolate. We need the concentration to be able to apply it and remember to apply our Dharma wisdom when things happen to us. And ethics, there was an example this week. I was reading in the Northern Territory, Woolworths wants to open a Dan Murphy's mega store. So they said, you know, in their prospectus or whatever, they've said, we respect Indigenous people, as if that's enough. You just say it and it's done, and you go and do something the exact opposite. Want to open a mega store against community opinion. So that's the difference between ethics lip service and ethics embodying it. So I always find it's really good to find examples like that that are very obvious and then go, oh, how do I, is there any way that I do that as well? Do I have any double standard? So we did have some reflection sheet last week as well. Anything stand out? Any questions, comments? Did anyone remember to apply what they've learned in the course to a problem that came up during the week? How are you going? Feedback, anything at all? How did you go?
I'm going super good.
Yeah, that's right. The cheesecake, as they say, the cheesecake's better in Toshita. The burgers are better in Toshita.
Yeah, so it's been really helpful.
The inner cheesecake.
Yeah.
As they say, like, become the cheesecake. So I knew you'd have something good to say about this because that's what we're going to look at tonight. Exactly that, of how when we kind of try and suppress what our, you know, what our yearnings are, instead of looking for the wisdom within them. And also when we try and suppress our suffering and our aversion just to get rid of it without seeing that there is some wisdom in there. Yep. So, and it sounds to me too that then you're applying concentration, which is just remembering to do it, remembering we've got this new way that we can look at things. That's so liberating. Great. Anybody else? Any other feedbacks, comments? Oh, right. Yes, the Stoics. Huge amount of parallels. Yes. Yeah, so Eddie's been reading a lot of the Stoics too and downloaded quite a few books, and a lot of the Stoics practices week by week are very, very similar as well. So if there was any kind of philosophical tradition that Buddhism was akin to, it would be the Stoics, for sure. So for us Westerners, it's a great bridge. Yeah. Okay, so let's have a look what we're going to have today. We're going to have a look at how to listen to the hidden wisdom within our experiences of unhappiness. So when we have boredom or stress or angst or just agitation, all the way along the spectrum up to depression and anxiety and fear. All of those experiences are they're results, they're symptoms of something going on within our own heart. And so instead of just trying to get rid of those experiences, have a look at what they're showing us. Where's the hidden wisdom in there? So in particular, we're going to look at how to break the toxic depression cycle and how to break the habit of worry. So the two biggies, isn't it? Depression and anxiety, they're endemic in our culture and in our modern day lifestyle. So let's just do a little short focus motivation. So we can deepen our purpose for being here, incorporate all those levels of happiness that we've talked about. But starting off on a very practical way, just adjusting our posture and making sure that you put a little bit of effort into straightening your spine. Imagine a fine thread of light running from the base of your spine up through your body, coming out the crown of your head. Feel your posture naturally align. Feel the weight of your body suspended from this thread of light. Especially if you've had a really long day. Take a couple of deep breaths and let your shoulders drop. Relax any tension from the neck and the shoulders. And make sure you're not kind of hunched over, but open the chest and heart area out a little. Have your head just slightly tilted forward, chin tucked in, slight smile on your lips, eyes very lightly closed, releasing any tension from the forehead, the frown lines. And bringing your focus to the breath, just breathing in and breathing out. Just becoming aware of the breath. Don't need to change your breathing in any way, just become aware of it. As you have your attention on the breath, you might become aware of the inner environment of your mind, your emotions tonight. So if you do, just notice and name. Notice if it's very busy. Notice if you're quite calm. Without judging, without getting involved, just as if you were a reporter. Just becoming aware of that inner environment as you anchor your attention on the breath. And whatever is going on in your mind, just note that it's not you, it's the contents of your mind. You're not your thoughts, you're not your emotions. But we can direct our mind. So we can direct it in the best possible way by adjusting our motivation. What's our purpose here tonight? Starting with whatever brought you here to this class, whatever reason it was. And then building on that reason, expanding it out, recognizing how you are connected with everyone in your life, who you go to school with, who you go to work with, who you live with, and you have the opportunity to be a fantastic influence on them, to help them, bring them happiness, not suffering. And you have a chance to overcome all the problems, not just make do, but actually completely overcome them so they no longer arise anymore. And all of us as human beings, we don't have to put any limit to what we can achieve. We can achieve all the way up to liberation and enlightenment. That's our potential. So broadening our purpose for being here to be inclusive of the welfare of ourselves and all living beings, and of an ultimate welfare of lasting happiness and peace. With this kind of confidence, then take a nice deep breath in through the nose and out through the mouth. Open your eyes if they're closed. Okay, so let's have a look at causes for depression and anxiety, how they come about, what kind of effect they have on us, what we can do about them. So quite a long time ago now, when His Holiness the Dalai Lama came to Brisbane, someone asked him about what's the Buddhist cure for depression and anxiety, because there are so many different strategies and ways to deal with disturbing emotions, all sorts of things in the Buddhist text. But His Holiness gave a really interesting response, which was that depression and anxiety are results, and they come from a multiple array of causes. So there can't be one thing that fixes them. We have to be able to actually trace back what the particular causes are and apply those. So for some things, there is one thing that fixes it, you know. So for when we're angry or short-tempered, the thing to cultivate is kindness and patience, and that's universal. It's a universal fix. But when we have anxiety or depression, because there might be many different causes, we've got to have a whole array of ways to deal with it. So I found it really practical, and the way that His Holiness answered the question was also really practical. He just went pretty much go straight to the easy thing first. Kind of go through the list and deal with the most obvious first, rather than going straight to the deep, profound, what's happening in my subconscious, oh my God. Actually, just check first, is it organic? So our experience of depression or anxiety can be because we've had changes in brain chemistry. So that could be because of PMT, having postnatal depression, having too much sugar, a sugar rush and a sugar crash. We've all had that, haven't we? But when it's happening to us, it's all consuming. Environmental pollution and poisoning. I had friends living in Tasmania. They lived in the inner city of Hobart and got really depressed and lethargic and had terrible concentration. they thought there was something, you know, terrible going on. They were going to marriage counselling, all sorts of things, but it actually turned out that they were living next door to a car body workshop, and they had an illegal smelter in there. So all the fumes were coming up from the chimney and into their bedroom window, which is where they would retire in depression. So it was this thing, and they didn't know that that was happening until they wanted to be part of the guide dog, raising guide dog puppies. And so the guide dogs, they come and they do an environmental audit of your place before they let you have the puppy. And they just said, your place is toxic and poisoned. You can't have the puppy. And they're, what? Total surprise. So it is really worth checking the most obvious things first. The environment, your diet, and it might come from an acquired injury. And so if it is, for instance, our diet, if we're drinking 12 cans of Coca-Cola a day and we're trying to deal with depression and anxiety, you've got to give yourself a break. It's a lot to expect to be able to continue doing that. Or if you're incredibly exhausted and sleep deprived and you try and sit down to meditate and just fall asleep straight away, probably the very best thing to do would be to get some sleep first. Okay. Then also response to events, to things that happen to us. And so we might have experienced some violence, random acts of violence or continuous violence in the home, aggression in the home. We might be experiencing feelings of helplessness. Well, didn't COVID bring that out? Not just helplessness, but uncertainty, income uncertainty, housing uncertainty. So when you're experiencing that, people would probably, if we can identify a thing like that, we'd go, well, of course you're feeling stressed or anxious. That's natural. And we often think we're a lot tougher than we are, don't we, until we go along and then kind of crash or burst into tears and go, where did that come from, and get really surprised about it. Or I noticed when we started coming out of lockdown and stopped having so many Zoom meetings and actually meeting in person, people were very vulnerable without knowing it. And so someone would say something and someone else would kind of be not quite taken aback, but it would really hit hard. And it's because we didn't realise, we've been locked up for so long, we didn't realise the effect it has, just a few words. And of course, when we suffer a death in the family, whether it's a family member or even a pet, can be really debilitating. And for that, it's worth knowing that the allotted amount of time that we're allowed for grieving. Does anyone know what that is in our society? It probably depends on, what profession you're in. I mean, it used to be when I was growing up in Melbourne, lots of Greeks and Italians around, and so when someone died, then the husband or the wife, they'd just wear black for a year. They went into mourning for a year. That was the thing that you did. Or you may not dye everything black. You may just have a black armband. Then I think it used to be about you could be in outright mourning for a couple of months. But after that, then your friends start saying, oh, come on, get over it. But there is no set time, is there? And then actually in the medical books, it's not to do with medicine, but it's to do with the law. So the amount of time that you're allowed to grieve before it becomes medicalized, a problem, before you're prescribed medication for it, has gone from 8 weeks to 4 weeks to 2 weeks. So it's a very arbitrary thing, and it's worth kind of knowing that we have to go through our own process. There's no cutoff line that this is legitimate grief and now it should be medicalized after this date. Then we also experience these kind of unhappy states because they're powered by our negative habit patterns. It becomes automatic, our automatic responses, and often how we felt as a child will color how we feel as an adult. So if you were neglected as a child, then as an adult, you make an appointment to have coffee with somebody and they don't show up, you're not just going to go, oh well, or, oh, maybe something happened to them. You're going to feel the whole weight of rejection and neglect upon you right back from that moment when you're a kiddie. And what happens is we relive it. And so in a way, it's like carving out this path, a response in our mind that we practice depression and we practice anxiety, we practice worry. And it means that we underestimate our own resources as adults, or our own resources as with our friends that can help us and support us. So everything gets coloured by our one or two experiences that were really stressful. We relive them again and again, and then it colours everything in our life. So it becomes very entrenched. And we think, oh, it's that thing back there that we have to deal with. But actually what we've got to deal with is the habit. It's the habit. So that's kind of getting a little bit more subtle and tricky. The other thing with habit patterns is how we make associations. So if someone's died at just as spring started, then every time spring starts, it takes you back to that death. We make associations. And from a Buddhist point of view, actually what drives these experiences of depression and anxiety are afflictive states of mind. So we know we have afflictive states of mind if we experience depression or anxiety, or the lesser ones, just boredom or stress or any of those things. If we have afflictive states of mind, which is things like the disturbing emotions, hatred, jealousy, resentment, but also all of the distortions that we might have with prejudice, with different types of fears and worries, distorted views, these will result in us being out of step, not feeling right in our own skin. So the really good thing about this is that if we look at this, we can see we might have some of these. If you see you've got all of these, then also be kind to yourself, because there's a lot to deal with right there. It might be that what you just have is the habit pattern left, but actually you've got good friends around you now, supportive friends. You've dealt with having a good diet. You're eating some vegetables finally. You're coming to class. You know, so there, at least to be able to gauge how much effort, energy you're going to be expending. So depression, stress, and anxiety are symptoms of disturbing emotions. They're not the cause. So they are evidence something's wrong. So if we're trying to deal with them, the thing isn't to get rid of depression and anxiety. That's just like putting a Band-Aid on. The thing is to get rid of these causes. But often when we have depression or anxiety, we just want that to go away. But as any doctor will tell you, you need to have symptoms, don't you? How can they tell what's wrong with you? It's from the symptoms. That's how you can read what's going on. If you go to a doctor and you just go, I don't know, just something doesn't feel right, what are they going to go on? So having an experience of depression or anxiety or stress or something like that is an excellent start. And what we can do when we look at those real root causes of the afflictive states of mind, the disturbing emotions, we can find the ones that that are really dominating for us, that really overwhelm us, and deal with those. So an example, my example that I had here was with the flu. So when we get the flu, how do we even know we've got the flu? Symptoms, what symptoms? Sore throat, what else? High temperature. Huh?
Mucus,
that's right. So all of those things. And so normally, before COVID, what did we used to do? Pop some pills and soldier on, isn't it? And go to work and give it to everybody else. So ironically, in 2020, the incidence of the flu went down 90% because everybody was social isolating, you know, being very careful with not passing on their symptoms. But before that, our whole culture had been just soldier on, just keep on going. And not only that, but just try and mask the symptoms. So if we have achy bones and a fever, and we just try and get rid of that, that's not necessarily going to help us get over the flu. The other thing is that those achy bones and that fever, that's actually evidence that your body's immune system is kicked in and is working. It's actually evidence that everything's going according to plan. It's before, you know, the fever breaks, isn't it, that it's really dangerous. So depression and anxiety are just like that. It's the evidence that something's going on. And I kind of like this analogy too, because just like we don't want to go to work and give the flu to everybody, when we are completely dominated by our disturbing emotions, it probably is a good idea to limit your contact with people so you don't say things that you regret, so that you don't make it worse, or to just be very careful with who you are with and have good mental hygiene like we talked about last week. So before we go on to some more nitty-gritty details, what questions so far? Anything at all? Comments, questions? Yes, please.
Mental hygiene. Do you
want to
break that down?
Yeah, so we talked about this last week when we were looking at concentration practices, the three higher trainings, but the first part of it is that when we notice ourselves ruminating on negative things, say being resentful, that we notice that we've got the presence of mind to go, oh, here's this habit pattern going around and around and around, and change the channel, do something else. Either get up and clean the house or start dancing or water the garden or pat the cat or take the dog for a walk or meditate on kindness, think about something you're looking forward to, all of those things, so that your internal environment's really clean. So if we could do that, you know, we stop that practicing of anxiety, because actually that's what our practice is most of the time. We just worry about things, don't we, over and over and over, and the worry doesn't get anywhere. It's just the same thing. So that's really poor mental hygiene, because what are we familiarizing our mind with? We're just actually making ourselves unhappy. And it gets its own momentum, and that's the difficulty with it. Okay, so listening to depression. So here's something interesting. Neurologically, there is no difference between sadness and depression. So what's happening in the brain when someone is experiencing sadness or grief, just being really sad, you know, their dog's died, or someone experiencing depression, neurologically what's going on, no different. So how come we think there is such a big difference between sadness and depression? Yeah, we embrace one, not the other. We certainly don't want to embrace depression, do we? But sadness, what do we do with sadness? It's rich. That's a good way to put it. What else about sadness? Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. So sadness has its poignancy, more short-term. Yeah, that makes sense. Whereas depression can seem to go on and on and on forever, though I think when we are sad, it feels like it's going to go on forever as well, doesn't it? Yeah.
Just related to that, like, sadness, I think of it as something that's with a cause, like something brought it on, some event.
Yep.
Whereas depression feels to me like, you know, condition.
Yep.
That is, you can be depressed for no reason.
Yeah, that's a big point. So if we can see a cause for sadness, it seems more legitimate, and we don't kind of take it personally as such, whereas depression, we can actually feel quite guilty about it or ashamed. Doesn't have necessarily an obvious cause. Yeah, so there's a different approach that we have. And also, what about, what kind of person does it make us? What kind of person are we when we're sad?
We can be quite reflective.
Yeah, we can be reflective. Wisdom.
And some cultures seem to embrace sadness in quite a positive way.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of...
Well, that's right.
Certain cultures seem to...
I mean, there's a reason we've got all those sad songs, isn't there? There's a reason we have sad music. So remember last week when we talked about cognitive fusion, that if something feels good, we think it is good. And if something feels bad, we think it is bad. This is the great tragedy of it, because sadness can be a very rich thing. It's not pleasant, but it can actually make us a better person, because how else are we going to have empathy? So if you've had a migraine and somebody else has a migraine, you know what they're going through. If you've never had a migraine, you'll just go, oh, come on, get over it. Then one day you have that migraine, then you go, oh, now I get it. And now suddenly you're much more gentle, isn't it? So that's the thing, that sadness can have this huge benefit of making us a better person. So we can develop empathy. Because of that, we become better human beings. If we're sad and have the courage to actually be raw or sad, we're much more likely to be kind to others. It's when we're trying to get rid of that feeling that we start being insensitive and gruff. We're trying to suppress it. Sadness can make us much more connected. So again, with COVID, you know, here we all were in our houses all by ourselves, but we could feel connected, isn't it? It's like this global experience. And that was powerful. We're more able to help others if we have an understanding what they're going through. And also, you know, like you were saying, with sadness, it can be useful. There is a legitimacy to it. So depression's got this whole other thing. And actually, a big difference with depression is that while sadness actually connects us to others, depression is it collapses inwards. It's very neurotic. And because of that, the result of that means that we feel alienated and isolated. When we're depressed, we feel alone, don't we? We feel like we're the only one going through this and nobody gets it. And it just, it's like a never-ending black hole, deeper and deeper and more isolated from others. Depression also, because just like the word, it is depressing our energy, it means the result is we become really stagnant emotionally. Alienates us from others. It also distresses those around us. And we can be quite oblivious of that when we're depressed. So I've lived with someone who's had clinical depression, and it's really tough because they've got no idea that everybody around them cares deeply about them. This oblivious and completely cut off from that. And also with depression, we feel there's no benefit. We can't find what's the purpose, what's the cause or legitimacy, and therefore we can't find that there's anything useful. So this is interesting because neurologically, no difference. Both of them feel bad, and yet one can be so beneficial and the other not. So what's the difference here? What makes it different? The impact, but what makes the impact different? The perception, you're right. Yeah, and so our perception often goes to the depression side of things through habit. So it might sound a bit pat that, you know, if we change our attitude, but actually this is a really powerful key if we change our attitude. So the Buddha had some radical cures for depression. Put that down here. Three radical cures, and they're quite counterintuitive. So what I would say with depression is we use everything that Western medicine has for us. We use our medication, because that actually gives us this space, a window of opportunity to do the work. Whatever self-help groups, whatever books that you can get your hands on, the help of your friends, and then these cures from the Buddha are actually cures for depression. They're not just kind of making do. But they are counterintuitive. So one of them, first one, remember death and impermanence. So taking the easy one first, remembering impermanence. And so many of the depression self-help groups, this is the core thing. This too shall pass. No matter how bad it feels, it will pass. And if you have someone who's leading that group who has had severe depression and come out of it, they're living proof of it. So even if you don't feel it, you can know this is true. So impermanence, thank goodness for impermanence. You know, most of the time we think, oh, impermanence is really bad. But in this instance, it cannot last forever. Even though it feels like it cannot last forever. The other thing is that if we have a near-death experience, or if we actually do come near to death, all of that depressive energy completely vanishes. So, you know, we can be moseying along and a bit disconsolate about our life. And if you have a near miss in a car crash, like, you know, or you don't quite have the car crash, but a near miss, then you're just like, oh, I'm so lucky. And now suddenly from being just blah, 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 you're like, thank goodness I'm still alive. It's a really different thing. Lama-Zo Rinpoche actually even went further that when we are having suicidal thoughts, underneath that, on a very subtle level, is this assumption that we are not going to die today. And so we have all the leisure in the world to think about it, to take it into our own hands. But actually, what if we thought the opposite? What if we thought, maybe I will die today? Maybe it's out of my hands. What if this was my last day on earth? How do I want to spend it? So it's taking this approach, instead of going into denial and pushing away, it's really embracing what's going on and having the courage to look at it straight up. Because impermanence and death, uncertainty, they're realities of our life. And I have been told that during a war, when there's bombs and stuff raining down and it's really outright life and death situation, there's no time to be depressed. No one's disconsolate. You're either alive today, yay, or you're battling for your life. There's no in between. So it puts it into perspective. And I think, you know, a lot of the time when we're kind of in that emotional funk and or when we are really, really depressed, there is this assumption that we have time. We have time to do it. So the next one, experience it on behalf of others. Think, this is not my depression. It's not all about me. Focus on the suffering of others just like you. So, you know, the first one is this too shall pass, but Buddhism goes a step further and says experience it for others. So this makes it useful. If we're going to go through this horrible experience, we can make it useful. So it's kind of like when people run a marathon, a charity marathon, they do it for someone, don't they? They sponsor it on behalf of somebody. So you go through a powerful action, something that means that you make some kind of sacrifice, you put in this effort and you do it on behalf of somebody. Yeah, I think so. It comes from compassion. And so if we have that courage to recognize our misery and be sad rather than try and squish it down and get depressed, then we can see, hey, it's not just me who's suffering this misery. There's others. And out of everybody here, for sure I'm not the most miserable. For sure there is somebody that is more miserable than me. And if I feel this bad, oh my gosh, how do they feel? So then you think, okay, well, what I go through, may it be beneficial for them. What I go through, may I be able to help others who are worse off than me. So many, many people transform their lives like this when terrible things happen to them, and they start up a group to help. I was reading about one lady who escaped a domestic violence situation, and she started up a escape bag. So it's just a little tiny thing where she got everybody to sponsor escape bags, so that if, usually it's a woman, if you leave the domestic violence situation and you've got nothing, there's all these places dotted around where you can go and you can pick up an escape bag, and it's got the stuff that you need for that night in it. What an amazing thing to do. So that's, you can transform really horrendous experiences into something that's useful for others. But we can only do that if we think it's not just my depression or it's not just my fear. Now, a little something to read from Buddhism for Dummies. This is a great book. Again, not just because of the cartoons in it, but actually it's legit Buddhism. It's just packaged in a very accessible way. So keep in mind that even when suffering, it can have its good points. Sometimes When things are going relatively smoothly for you, you can more easily ignore the difficulties of others. But when you yourself encounter these same difficulties, you're more likely to open your heart and experience empathy. As your heart opens, your loving compassion also grows stronger. If you can use your difficulties to help generate genuine and deeply felt compassion for others, one of the most beautiful and liberating of all spiritual qualities, then your suffering was definitely worthwhile. And then the last point, also a radical point, is give it to your ego. Give your depression to your ego. So put the blame on the right place. We have this instinctual urge to blame. And in fact, a lot of depression comes from blame. Blaming others, blaming other situations, blaming how things didn't turn out. And it is it's a compulsive blaming. So sometimes we just got to work with that energy. We can't just stop it in its tracks. So if you're going to blame the right thing. So it's not you, because when we say, oh, it's you, what we're usually pointing out is all the good things about you, isn't it? So you can't blame yourself. You can't say, oh, I'm depressed because I'm so bad, or I'm hopeless, or it's all my fault. That's just not true, because the me that you're talking about then is usually the one that's trying to be your best self, the vulnerable one, the one that's putting in all the effort. So if you're going to blame anything, blame the disturbing emotions. Blame the distorted states of mind. Blame the assumptions. Blame the projections. And definitely blame the ego, because that's the one that's made all the problems for us. And the ego is not you. So even in a lot of Buddhist practices, you'll hear gather all blame up into one. Sometimes it's translated as put it on the self, but Geshe Zopa pointed out on Sunday, it's put it on the self-cherishing, put it on the self-grasping, not the self. So I really like this one, because when I feel my compulsive urge to blame, like who did it, who's at fault, it wasn't me, then at least get the target right where it's going to be useful. Because while we're blaming other people, while we're blaming our circumstances, we cannot fix that. We are giving away all of our power. Yeah.
That usually makes sense when an issue is like living on a daily basis. But what about if you have a traumatic experience? Someone has actually intentionally hurt you, whether that's a friend, a partner, or a parent, and you have like proof that they have harmed you.
Yep. Yep. So when you've been harmed, that's different from depression and anxiety. That's that kind of first one of having, a traumatic experience. But then that traumatic experience is over, and what we're left with is reliving the traumatic experience. And that's where the problem is. So the traumatic experience, yes, someone's harmed you, and it was wrong, and you probably got to get out of there, and you're probably traumatized, and it's going to take a while to heal. But what happens? Depression, anxiety comes in and relives it and re-triggers that trauma again and again and again until it becomes your modus operandi. And so you can no longer blame that experience anymore. You've got to blame the habit. So it's because when we have something like that happen to us, we don't know how to deal with it. And our first thing how to deal with it is to squash it down and try and not feel it. And the result of that is anxiety and depression. So it's quite a tricky thing, because it doesn't mean that then we go and say, oh, what happened was great and fine. No, it was traumatic and terrible, but how we're responding to it changes over time. And often if we haven't dealt with that pain, it will turn into depression and anxiety. And what drives that? The disturbing emotions, the wanting to blame others, the saying it is your fault that I'm unhappy. Whereas actually that person did this terrible thing to me, but how I respond that's up to me. And I mightn't have been up to me at the time, but now it's up to me. And there's all this help that we can get to do that. So we start changing who's at fault. So while we're always thinking it's their fault, we are stuck. And we will never get out of it.
So like that is kind of a saying, like, you know, something intriguing of blaming yourself, you know that one?
Yeah.
It's kind of like...
Oh, blame. Yes, that's right.
It harms me, you know. And then, I mean, like you said, it's that's done and gone, but the continuation of you keep kind of stabbing yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
You did it once, yeah. But you holding it is like you're walking around carrying it all the time, and you know.
Yeah, so they say with trauma that, so we, you know, say if something traumatic happened in a particular place, then every time you see that place, you relive that trauma. So that's on us. We are doing that until similar places to that will relive that trauma, until our whole life is traumatized. So it's because we don't know how to get over trauma. And part of it is to actually go through that experience and sit with it. And we can't do that whilst we're going, no!
Just one other thought. Also, like, if something I was working with, I found forgiveness, like, helped me, like, because, like, what you said a couple of sessions ago, it was like, they're not bad, they did something bad. And then, like, if I
yes.
could forgive them, like, for me, that shifted that whole blaming thing, which I realized was just me. Causing pain to myself because of something that I did to
And
me.
Forgiveness, where does that come from? How do we actually experience that forgiveness? Well, it's like if we can see that the other person is also suffering, they know not what they do and they're completely overwhelmed by their negative emotions. So again, it's blaming the right thing. It's not blaming the person. It's blaming their destructive behavior. It's blaming their negative emotions. It's blaming all of the wrong decisions that they made, but it's not blaming that person because that person's just like me, you know, struggling and not necessarily doing a good job and probably doing a way worse job than me, but still. A way to get to that also is to imagine them as a kitty, and then you can't hate them anymore. You know, as a kitty, then you just have to blame their disturbing emotions. So the question, how interested are we in the welfare of others? That will help us get out of this neuroses of depression and anxiety that's very... ego-centered. So you know what makes us feel isolated is our ego. What makes us harm others is our ego. Our egos are a million times worse than any external terrorist because of the results that come from it. So that's something worth blaming with great gusto and not the person. So I think then we can reach a middle ground where we can understand that person, they know not what they do, but you may not ever have to have anything to do with them. That might be the smart thing. But in your heart, you're free. Okay, so then deep breath. That's the depression side of things. I told you they're radical, right? Anxiety and fear. This is something in a way far easier. And actually, I had a thing to read as well. Oh, from here. So this is from Kathleen McDonald, How to Meditate. Really excellent workbook. And in the chapter called Dealing with Negative Energy, under the heading fear. In traditional Buddhist explanations of the delusions or the disturbing emotions, fear is not usually mentioned, but it is a common cause of unhappiness and stress. Fear is not necessarily negative. It depends on what we're afraid of and how we handle our fears. It can, in fact, be useful in our everyday life, as well as in our spiritual practice. Fear of hurting ourselves and others in a car accident motivates us to drive carefully and observe the rules of the road. Fear of a disease and an early death motivates us to eat wisely, take care of our health. Fear of a negative, out-of-control state of mind motivates us to prepare ourselves by developing a spiritual practice. Fear of the painful consequences of negative actions motivates us to refrain from creating bad karma and to act compassionately. So you kind of get the gist. Nevertheless, fear can bring negative results. It disturbs our peace of mind. It can harm our health. It causes us to see things in a mistaken way, and it can motivate us to act irrationally or destructively. So it is something that we should aim to overcome. In fact, one of the qualities of an enlightened mind is a being free of all fears. So it is possible to become free of all fears. But kind of as beginners, there is, again, a difference between anxiety and fear, just like there was between just misery and sadness and depression, which is debilitating. So anxiety is quite debilitating, whereas fear, it can actually accurately reflect a situation. Some things it's good to be fearful of. It's not pleasant, but it keeps us safe. So you might have gathered by now, I love late night TV, and one of the late night TVs is a Thing of the Extreme collection, and they have these things of parkour, these guys jumping over and under things and whatever, really, really fast. And there's one guy that does it on the top of buildings. So he climbs up to the building and he runs along all the struts. No fear. Oh my God, gets me behind the back of my knees. So this, in my mind, this is stupid behavior, right? There are some things that it's worth being fearful of. Keeps you safe. So for that, it's not necessarily an afflictive emotion. Not pleasant, but important. But then anxiety. So anxiety we kind of look at as a out of proportion response to a situation. We see it's negative or it has no benefit. And if we don't have good mental hygiene, if we're not aware, and if our habit has already taken a hold of us, what happens is we dwell on it, we get this negative cycle, and we become more and more worried, more and more anxious, a lot of social anxiety, until the original cause of it has long gone, and now it's just our natural state of being, to be in a state of worry. So I really relate to this. I've known Lama Zopa Rinpoche since I was a little child, and every time he'd come to Australia and I'd get to say hello for a minute or two, and every single time from since I was little, he'd say, "Miffy, don't worry." And I'd go, "How?" I'm worried about everything all the time. So anxious, so fretful. So that's really debilitating. Social anxiety, also really debilitating. But some worries and some anxieties are there with wisdom. So we've got to be able to tell what is an out of proportion response and what is actually something that's legitimate and worth us looking at. And the irony about anxiety is, if we fight against it, it makes it worse. It actually just concretizes it. One of the things that I learned when I first came here to Lungri Tongpa Centre was that everybody else is more nervous than me. Took me a while to figure that out. And then I found out that, and it was from some self-help talk or something, that you just think, I'm going to carry the shyness of others. So instead of me being shy and intimidated, going into a room, oh my God, what's everyone going to think of me? Well, everybody else is actually feeling that and worse, so I'm going to carry it for them. So you think, I'm going to take their social anxiety from them. I'm going to take their shyness from them. I'll wear it. And that really helped me. So then I was kind of able to relax. And then it actually changed my personality. So after being in reception for, 12 years, when I first got here, the Myers-Briggs typology test, I was introverted. Yes, I know. I put on a good show, don't I? So actually, I was an INTJ. For those of you in the know, my natural propensity is to be quiet and introverted. But then obviously I overcompensate, right? But what happened was having to be welcoming people. What do I do here? You know, just to set foot in a Buddhist center for the first time can be quite intimidating. And so kind of recognizing that. After about 8 years, I went and did that Myers-Briggs typology again. My personality had changed just through practice. So now I'm not way over on the introvert. I'm smack bang in the middle. So you can change, and it's mostly to do with habits. So something else about stress as well, that you know, our feelings are not facts. And stress, we often think our stress is bad because it feels bad. So there's that cognitive fusion happening again. And if anyone asked you, oh, you know, do you want to be less stressed at work or more stressed at work? I pretty much could guess what you'd say. But actually, we need stress. We actually need stress to become strong. So cognitive fusion, it feels bad, therefore it is bad. So things get stressful or we're anxious. It feels bad and we think it's a bad thing and therefore we want to get rid of it. And so we push it away. So before I talk about the stress, with the anxiety, what I've actually found that anxiety has been really helpful for me, especially here at Lungri Tongpa Centre, because having a bit of anxiety before class has meant that I can focus. Because some adrenaline comes up and instead of being all kind of floppy and chilled, I have this rush of anxiety and adrenaline, and then I get a little bit tunnel vision and then I focus and then I know what I'm leading the class on. It's been incredibly helpful. But the key has been to go, yeah, anxiety feels terrible. Don't worry about it, Miffy. Feels bad, doesn't matter. Feels bad, it's just an emotional sensation. Don't worry about it. So it takes the pressure off. Don't try and not feel it. Don't try and make it good, but it's useful. And Pearly, my friend who's a singer, says also just before you go on stage, you need that. And so she found that she asked one of the musicians, you know, do you ever get stage fright or do you ever get nervous before you go on? And he said, no, I don't get nervous. I get really excited. And neurologically, nerves and excitement, nerves and anticipation, identical. But back to the stress. So we need stress. Human beings need intermittent stress to grow and develop. So, you know, the astronauts, when they go off into space and they're in zero gravity and every morning they just float out of bed, you know, they don't have to like drag themselves out of bed. They're just like, woo, floating around. You might just think that is awesome. I know I would. But then when they come back to Earth, maybe a year ago, a couple came back to Earth and they had to carry them in a chair. Did you see it? They were there in like their space chairs and four people were carrying them from where the thing dropped down into the ocean. Why? They couldn't walk. They'd lost all their muscle mass from just floating around. So it looked like they were being really regal, but actually they couldn't even lift their arms, let alone walk. So the fact that we're walking around and we are fighting against gravity the whole time means that we have bone density and we have muscles. And if we didn't have that stress, we'd just be like those astronauts. Like, how many months does it take them to get back again? And that's still with doing all those exercises in space. So it's a particular sort of stress, though. It's stress like when you're doing weight training. You know, you have some stress and then you have some rest. It's got to be, you know, bit by bit, intermittent. So if we have stress, if we've got a kind of a difficult home life, for instance, if we have a lot of stress at home or a lot of threat of violence, that's not intermittent, that's continuous, and that's going to be really debilitating. Then your adrenal glands will be shot and all sorts of things. But we've got to resist that thought to think, I want to get rid of all stress and all problems are bad, because we need those problems to grow. We need them to get some emotional fortitude. And if we don't have the problems, one day when a problem does come, we'll be completely unprepared. So actually, when COVID happened and we had to stay home and there was very little that we could do, the people that I noticed at Langri Tumpa Centre who fared the best were the ones that had the worst health problems, because they were used to it. You know, so like Meta with her heart problem, she comes halfway up the stairs and then she has to have a rest, because otherwise she'll have a heart attack by the time she gets to the top. So she holds onto the beam and she has a bit of a rest. Then she gets up to the landing, she has a bit of a rest, and then she does the last three. But when the lockdown happened, she already had all this fortitude. It wasn't emotionally straining or stressful at all. In fact, she was embracing it. Great, I can get all these things done. I can do all this study and la, la, la. Whereas other people who'd been gallivanting about doing whatever you want, suddenly it was so confronting and debilitating. So we need intermittent stress and resilience. You know, that's this thing where, I mean, it's a term that's bandied about a lot, but what a resilience is actually is this strength that comes from being able to live through problems, experiencing problems, the ability to voluntarily bear suffering and profit from any situation. So it's quite a different way of looking at problems. When things go wrong, even though we might feel it's bad, actually that's not a fact. Actually, it could be a very good thing for us. We could profit from it. In fact, we could become a better human being from it. And I think you mentioned too, James, about, you know, if we don't have failure, then we're not going to have any successes. Very profound. So how to break the habit of worry then, you know, keeping that all in mind, what to do? Listen to your worry. Have the courage to listen to your worry. What's it actually saying? So normally we just panic, we get anxious and we go, oh, I don't want it. So it's kind of like the first thing, breathe, sit with it, don't try and get rid of it, and try and listen, what's the anxiety actually saying? So the great Saint Shantideva said, if you can do something about a situation, what is the point of worrying? And if you cannot do anything about a situation, there is no point in worrying. So this is what Lama Zopa Rinpoche had to say to me every single time. So to put this into perspective, a couple of years ago, with young people in Australia, and I can't remember which state it was in, but they noticed that there was a lot of anxiety about climate change. And so the region's response to that was to start a group to get rid of the anxiety about climate change. To actually, like, does that strike you as odd? As if it's the anxiety that's the problem? So actually, if it was out of proportion, it would be a problem. But there is no way that can be out of proportion. In fact, it's the other way. We're so oblivious. But we panic, don't we? We just want to get rid of the bad feeling. Actually, all of us need anxiety about climate change right now, and then we have to go and do something about it. And then we'll have a climate. So I think that that whole thing, that's just the microcosm of it right there. I know the way we'll deal with climate change is just get rid of anxiety. It's what Florida did. They just banned the use of the word climate change. Fixed. Problem solved. So mindfulness, really quickly, some really easy things what to do. Mindfulness meaning becoming aware when you're anxious, becoming aware how your body gets a bit tense, your breathing changes, your feeling tone changes, recognizing their emotional sensations, they're not you. And mindfulness meaning becoming aware of that and letting it be without trying to change it. And then if you do need to do something, change your breathing. And the go-to one with this is to make sure that your out-breath is longer than your in-breath. It's that simple. So that's the same for how to go to sleep. To get into a relaxed state to actually be able to go to sleep, your out-breath longer than your in-breath. Whereas if you're lying there going, go to sleep, I can guarantee your breathing's not in a nice, relaxed way. If you're having a panic attack, also, this is how to do it. You breathe out for 6 and in for 2. Or any of the really nice breathing meditations, 9-round breathing. Cut out the dietary extremes. The 12 cups of coffee or the 12 cans of Coke. It's really worth doing that. So years ago in my 20s, and I actually thought I had like agoraphobia, and I think I had a lot of social anxiety and probably had a bit of agoraphobia. But what would happen was I'd force myself to go out of the house, and I'd manage to get to a coffee shop in West End. And then I'd be so terrified and so shy, all I could do was just sit there and drink coffee. So what do you think happened? I just like almost got lockjaw from the amount of caffeine, and so stressed I couldn't even put my head up. And then I was like, oh my God, how am I even going to get home now? So total extremes. It just would have been better if I had sat there and just had a smoothie or something, you know. Do it for others. Use your worry, use your anxiety or your adrenaline for others. And part of that is to recognize how adrenaline can have, it can be very useful for us. Doing it for others also is that way of holding everybody else's social anxiety for them. If you find yourself catastrophizing late at night, just write a list. Because when you're just catastrophizing in your mind, they just get bigger and bigger. You know, it's kind of dark, and that darkness can go on forever. But the moment you turn the light on, you try and capture it with words. You put it back in its box. And once you write it down, all of the things that you're terrified of or worried about, then very easily right next to it, you can write one thing you can do about each thing. And that might sound a bit pat, but actually it gives us back our agency. Because one of the most debilitating things is feeling helpless. So the moment we start, we can do something about it, like that lady who had the escape bags. So all she could do at first, someone taught her to sew, and the only thing she could sew was the tote bag, a rectangle and two handles. And she made hundreds of them, and that was her way of getting through the stress and the trauma, just doing this physical activity. And then she started thinking, what can I do with these tote bags? And then she thought, I'll have them as supplies. And then it's grown into such a thing now that actually she needs more people to help her make the bags and put them all together. And it just came from just write a list, one thing you can do. And to stop seeking satisfaction from external conditions. So the main cause of our stress isn't those external conditions. The main cause of stress or anxiety is a dissatisfied mind. But, you know, because our focus is always drawn outwards, we think if we just change jobs or we just change this or that, but as we know, we get to a new job and we get stressed all over again. So we think, if I could only just change this one thing, everything would be okay. But actually, whether we're stressed or not, it's determined by our capacity to feel happiness or not. And if we have a dissatisfied mind, if we're living in a constantly dissatisfied state, we are going to experience stress, even if we're in really good conditions. So here we were in lockdown in Australia with, you know, food delivered to the door, and most people had a house to live in and NBN so we could talk to whoever we wanted to without even having to get off the couch, and yet so many people were stressed because of the dissatisfied mind. And have the courage to listen to your anxiety. So there is always hidden wisdom in there. And we'll still be anxious until we pinpoint what that wisdom is. And we're still going to have anxiety about climate change until we actually start changing the climate. So before we finish, last questions or comments or anything about this kind of other side of things, that anxiety, stress. Sometimes we can't do anything about that feeling. It's really powerful. It's overwhelming. And we may not even know what it is. We mightn't even be able to identify it. So the starting thing is to go, I'm having an intense experience. So it's kind of like that's the mindfulness comes in and goes, notice and name. So notice I feel bad and name it. Even if you can't pin what it is. Yeah.
I don't like big crowds. I worked back to when I was a boy going to football matches in the 60s in England and having big people all around.
Oh, yeah.
And just one particular incident, I
And then you've got the reverberations of that incident in a big crowd, and then it, yeah, that's right, it flavours everything else. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like putting the puzzle pieces together. But even if you can't put the puzzle pieces together, to recognise it's a bad feeling, but it's not necessarily a fact. What the feeling is telling you isn't necessarily true. So it's really basic to just notice, oh, it's a bad feeling, and then whereabouts am I feeling it? Am I tight in the chest? How's my breathing? Do I feel really agitated? Do I feel really tired? Start describing it. Whereabouts do you feel it? And that gives you the courage to look in. And then I know in my mind, I go, what is it? What is it? What is it? Trying to figure out what it is. And you may or may not find it, but the first thing is to have that courage to sit with it. Normally, the moment we have a bad feeling, we panic and we just try and get rid of it straight away. And that's kind of disastrous. So the whole mindfulness and breathing is to notice something's quite bad and notice it way before we start being debilitated. The dissatisfied mind. Oh, I'm a bit dissatisfied today. Or I notice because I just start crashing into things. You know, I've got all these bruises on my legs walking to the side of the table, and I go, oh, okay, I'm a bit disassociated. I better slow down a bit. Who knows what it's about? But just notice what's going on as soon as you can. And then the feelings come, and then name them as emotional sensations. So it might be, a fear of crowds that's triggered, but it might be there is a general underlying angst or fear that is triggered by a crowd, but it might be triggered by some other thing as well. So the thing isn't the crowds. In fact, some crowds are worth being fearful of. That's not an exaggerated thing at all. It's not out of proportion. It could keep you safe. So if you've ever been at a large party and suddenly the tone changes and you go, it's time to get out of here now because it's about to get violent. So it's a good thing. But while we're panicking and going, I don't want this feeling, then we miss the wisdom in it. And if we have that just every day, we just try and do a bit of sitting and just see how it's going, like a reporter, without jumping to any conclusions. Whether you can find a reason or not doesn't matter. It's not a bad thing. Just become aware of that internal weather. Then it's less likely to creep up on us. So the last little bit then, in summary, depression and anxiety are signs that you're out of step with yourself. They're not signs that you're bad or broken or that things have gone terribly wrong. It's just that you're out of step, you're out of kilter, they're a symptom, they're not the problem. So trying to get rid of the depression or the anxiety is not the way to go. They're our friend. They're showing us something's wrong. And in fact, they are the first signs of healing. So it's like all of your qualities trying to break through, like a little bud trying to break through out of the mud. So it feels bad, but it's a good sign. Just like the fever of depression can be a path to compassion. It can be a real path to a genuine empathy and care for others. And our stress actually is what helps us be strong, what grows our resilience. So let's see. Homework, there are some self-reflection sheets for those of you with the notes. And just in general, to try and reframe your experience by using your words. So instead of saying, oh, this is bad, try saying, oh, this is good. Just turn it around. So that instead of panicking, we can really find that wisdom in there, in our experience. And just before we dedicate, the next week we're going to look at the power of habit. So we've seen how a lot of depression and anxiety is propelled by habit. So how do we deconstruct those habits? Because you can't just force habits. They have to be undone bit by bit. So let's dedicate the merits. Let's gather up all of the energy tonight coming through the storm, our stormy Tuesdays. Hopefully next week won't be a storm. And appreciating your efforts of getting here and of focusing, putting the, you know, using your concentration and your wisdom, your reflection. Acknowledge your efforts of even talking about topics that are unpleasant. It takes courage. And recognize how if we didn't have problems, we wouldn't have been propelled into this course, into trying to make our life better. We have a real incentive to help ourselves. And if we can help ourselves, we'll be able to help others. Just by us going through problems, we'll be able to help others in a very genuine way. So dedicate all of your efforts to being able to deal with day to day, have the courage to listen to the wisdom in your anxiety and depression, but for the long term, to bring forth that wisdom, to become completely liberated from the ups and downs of disturbing emotions, and to become enlightened or awakened to reach your full potential for the benefit of all. So thank you. Thank you so much for coming. I really hope to see you next week. Those of you online, please stay online. I'll be there in a sec. Rachel, was that you waving? Yes. Yes, go for it.
So my question was in regards to the negative habit patterns. So it's like, how do you identify you're trying to break a negative pattern by like doing something positive, or are you merely trying to distract yourself from that negative feeling?
Yep. It's to do with which part of the cycle you're at. So if you're already ruminating and you're already in a really destructive habit pattern, then it's best to physically get up and go and do something else, be in another room, do something else physically. And that way you can change your mental state rather than just trying to sit there and force it. So often people might just sit there and just try and talk it out, for instance, but you're in the same room and you're in the same environment, and it's actually a really big struggle. It's better to get up and go for a walk and talk it out. Or so that's already if it's already started. But the aim is to be able to take our emotional temperature every morning in meditation and gauge, I'm feeling a bit fragile today, or I'm feeling quite okay today, or I'm a bit impatient. Take that internal temperature so that you can calibrate it before things go wrong.
Mm.
So it's to do with which part of the cycle we're at. So next week we're going to have a look at the habit cycle, because there's about six different steps in there, and the changing the channel one is already way into it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the easy thing to do when things are already bad and you're already depressed or already anxious. It's to take yourself out of it and do something else.
Yeah.
Okay, who else? Wave at me. Anne's iPad.
Sorry, I forgot to change the name.
And done. Tell me, how are you going?
Good, Miffy. I've got a question on the reflection sheet on page 10. It was, I'll just get it so I get the exact thing, about why get up and ask yourself three times. And
yep.
Some days I've done that really successfully, and some days I just go, why not get up? I'm just tired, going to go back to sleep or something, you know, or else just really struggle to get those feet out of bed. And some of that's to do with tiredness. Some of it's I'm very skilled at having the answers, which are not getting up. And I even wondered if I should flip it and at nighttime go, set an alarm at a certain time and go, why do I need to go to bed? Because I've got more kind of direction answers for that rather than when I'm in bed in the morning.
Well, yeah. I've got to say I'm probably not a good example on this one because I hate going to bed and I go to bed really late and ever since a child, like, I've hated going to bed. And so then I never get enough sleep. Then I wake up and I'm okay for a while, but if I don't have my nap, I'm cactus. So yeah. I suppose it's more to do with if you can't find a reason to get out of bed, just own it. Mm. And because often the rat race reasons, they are not enough. They do not cut it. Those worldly concerns, they do not cut it. And forcing yourself takes a lot of energy and then we snap. So even if you're in a dead-end job and it's really toxic work culture and whatever, there's got to be a reason to go. And if it's a reason to feed your family, instead of just like grinding it out, you've got to remember, oh, yeah, my family. I love my family. I want them to be happy. And not just that, but to have a worthwhile life, we're going to make the world a better place together. And it's worth going to work for.
And it was always easier when I worked because I had to go to work. Was like, whereas now it's, today was good, but I still ended up sleeping in because I had Eddie's class. And it was like, well, I've got to get up and have something to eat so I can concentrate. And some days I've done it really well just because it feels good to exercise. It feels good to do the morning walk. But, yeah, there's a bit of self-defeating with it. So I like the three questions, like to do it three times. I mean, I think that's what I'm probably fighting against is my own brain fighting it, you know.
But also, it's like when we have an external structure, it is so much easier. When we have a family to get up for, it is so much easier, or a job to go to, it's so much easier. So part of it is that it's an external structure, but part of it is you're doing it for others. So as a Buddhist, you have a structure, but it's an internal one, but you get up and you go to work for others. You get up and you bless your speech and you do your prayers. And you're ready then to meet the needs of whoever you see that day. And you think of it as going to work for sentient beings.
Yeah, that's good. And I do. I have my daily practice. Sometimes I often do it in bed, like Geshe Zopa said, do it immediately. I remember that whole 2 days I went to and I do it. But then I go, well, now I've done it, I can lie down. It's like get out of bed and do your practice because, you know, it's interesting what kind of keeps us there, but
I mean, the other thing that'll do it too, Anne, is just thinking if our leisure is threatened to be taken away. So if suddenly you get a job and you've only got 2 more weeks to go till you start work, now suddenly you know all the things you want to do.
That's right. So and
impermanence. We tend to forget death and impermanence. I found thinking about, oh, well, I could die tomorrow, that just freaks me out and I freeze. But thinking about a little bit longer, what if I only had 2 years? Or what if I only had 1 year? Then it becomes very clear to me what I'm just stuffing around with and what I actually want to achieve.
And I like that one of others too, like I'm getting out of bed for the others, or I might be dedicating to those who can't get out of bed, who are in wheelchairs and need help or something. That is a really good motivator because that will be part of my practice then too. So thank you.
Good on you, Anne.
In the end.
Yeah, you did. Okay. Who else? Tracy, did you have a question? No, who else? Other Anne, Anne Keenan? How did you go? No, no, no. Who else? Mark, you were here last week too, weren't you?
I was. I had to run off. I had screaming children who needed to be helped out. Yes. They're good for anxiety too. I was going to ask, on the anxiety front, when so in the moment, there's mindfulness and ways of managing issues. But sort of broadly, what Buddhism can offer, if you do identify, so you've through whatever means you've worked out, actually a lot of this anxiety is because of this thing, like you say, neglect or something way back in your past. Does Buddhism then offer a way of resolving that? Is that through meditation or?
Yeah, and it's quite different from our Western psychology, because Western psychology goes back into our life and sees that the cause of our suffering is from events, things that happen to us. So it's an external thing. So Buddhism takes it a layer deeper and says it cannot be that external thing, because that same thing could have happened to two people and they respond totally differently. So that external thing can only be a condition. It's not a cause. And so if we want to, one way we could look at it is some other thing could have happened and it would have been a condition for that same sense of anxiety. You know, there could have been any array of things, but that was that one thing that happened. So then we look at why, when that thing happened and we responded, like, why did it stick? Why did that experience take root in us? So that bit's from our side, because we have we're vulnerable, or we have a distorted view, or we have a disturbing emotion, or we have a worry or a fear. That's from our side, and that's what we can heal and change. So it's, in a way, it takes a lot. There's a lot more responsibility on our side, but it also means, unlike Western psychology, where you can't fix it. You know, the thing happened to you, you can't undo it. But in Buddhism, you can fix it, because the crucial part of it isn't what happened. The crucial part is why it took root in our mind, and that we can definitely work through. So when we were talking last week on the three principal aspects of the path and how the wisdom is that what cuts all the problems at the root. So the reason, for instance, that we even feel fear or anxiety right at the root isn't to do with frightening situations. It's to do with our self-grasping and self-cherishing and grasping onto an identity that doesn't exist in that way. And it's like grasping onto shifting sand, so of course we get frightened. So, you know, the Western psychology is very good with dealing with the situation, but it cannot solve it, it can't deal with the cause. Yeah, Tracy.
I've been reading a lot of work lately by the professor of psychology, or psychiatry actually, at Stanford University. And he's a really interesting guy, because he's a medical doctor, a psychiatrist, brought up in the Western tradition, and a Christian man. But he's actually draws on Buddhist philosophy a lot in his therapy. And he works on that whole idea of it's not the event, it's how you perceive the event which causes the problem, and that he can cure depression and anxiety even for decades length of time, and drug therapy and talk therapy, he can cure it within a couple of hours for most people. You should have a look at him. I think he's really interested. His name's David Byrne, and he wrote a book about 30 years ago, and it's become like a practitioner's manual in America. But yeah, very similar sort of philosophy. So I think he's borrowed heavily from Buddhism.
I'm just writing that down. That is really good to know. So a lot of clinical treatments like that are like evidence-based, are incredibly useful, and of course they're very parallel to the Buddhist understanding. And then the Buddhist understanding goes even deeper as to like why do we even get anxiety or depression in the first place.
Well, it's really interesting too because he talks about the concept of no self as well. So he doesn't sort of go into the whole sort of stream of consciousness thing, but yeah, he says that he gave up having a self years ago and he's never looked back since then.
Oh, if only it was that easy.
But yeah, he's a great guy. He works cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah.
It's called team therapy. So yeah, definitely worth a look at. And someone who has had a lot of mental health problems for a long period of time, and I found his work amazing.
Yeah.
And the results amazing.
That's just really great to hear. So the cognitive behavior therapy, that's CBT, it works in very harmoniously with the Buddhist understanding of psychology. It's really fantastic. And actually, I find those Western traditions, the techniques that they use, like the exercises and things, they're just fantastic. They're really dynamo and they really speak to a Western sensibility a lot easier than at first if you sit down and do the standard Buddhist meditations. Yeah. There needs to be a little bit of a bridge.
That's right, because sometimes, you know, it's difficult for someone brought up in a Western society to understand the import of a lot of the ideas in that.
And even just how we do exercises. I mean, the Tibetans are used to just sitting down and meditating and reflecting, and we're no good at that. We're much better at doing quizzes or having conversations or doing little mind exercises, talking about it, all of those things, like talk therapies, way before we sit down and do a contemplation. You know, we have to have developed our concentration and ability to focus and all of that before we can do that. And if we're all stressed, how are we going to focus or concentrate? Well, it sounds really fruitful, everybody. Yes, it turned out more people online than I expected tonight, which was great. And I always feel a little bit bad because I can't kind of interact with you during the class. But I'm just looking at the comments here. Tracy, you also said, that's right, sadness has an easily identifiable cause and depression not always. Yep, that's right. And I think part of that one is that if we can identify a cause, then we don't feel like such an idiot. But if we can't identify a cause, we feel like an idiot, or there's something wrong with us, or we make this conclusion that there is no cause, that it's just random. You know, if we can't find a cause, we assume there is no cause, and then that is terrible. But that's actually a mistake. There's anything we experience necessarily had a cause. So even if we can't identify it straight away, so even like when I'm going through something and I'll just notice, okay, I'm going through some kind of internal tantrum or internal panic or something, I'll just notice that and name it and go, well, I don't know what that's about yet, but I just know if I'm going to push, it's not going to work. So just sit with it for a while, and then it percolates around and I go, oh, maybe that's what it's about. slowly.
It's hard to see the trees when you're in the woods.
And especially when you're in the woods running around in circles.
I was going to just make a comment, Miffy. I found it really helpful looking at, I'm trying to find the page so I can say this coherently, in that kind of response to events and talking about past trauma. And, I mean, you know, I've studied this stuff for years, but it was really snappy and quick. It was like, what's really happening when you're kind of like, it could be a post-traumatic reaction or something. It's not that we're actually so much living it. We're just going back, and it's a rumination even. I mean, that I don't want to dismiss post-traumatic stress, but it was helpful for me having, because I've had a few things come up with a bad relationship years ago, and it's sort of just, I'm going, what? Now I'm nearly 70. This is going to be happening to me. What's going on? And that really helped me see, well, look, it's really just your mind, and you can do something about this. Yeah.
Yeah. Really, so it's a lot of so the trauma, however strong the trauma was, the healing has to have the same amount of power. Yep. So if you're a soldier and you go to Afghanistan for 8 months and you come back with post-traumatic stress, the healing has to be the same duration and the same intensity.
Mm.
And it can be done. And, in fact, you could have a stronger intensity for, you know, more time if you go into like an emotional boot camp or a and actually deal with it with shorter than 8 months. But to expect to just have it less than that, that's unrealistic. So we have a trauma, and it might have been something that happened once, or it might have been over a few years. If it's over a few years, it's going to take us minimum a few years of that amount of intensity to remake tracks within our mind, our experiences.
Yeah, so 20-something years, and then being just like walking away and going, yeah, that's all fixed, and then suddenly I'm wondering why, okay, you're going to have to do it.
It's going to come back. And so we can, for some of them, like and the Buddhist retreats, like the Nyungne retreats, for instance, they are just an immersion thing where we do completely reboot, and it can completely reboot for years of trauma. But what happens with trauma is that we have the initial trauma and then we relive it. So actually we are re-traumatizing ourselves.
Yep.
There's two things. There's the echo of the first trauma, and then we relive it again and then again. And what we do is we call that a trigger. We get triggered. But what getting triggered means isn't that first experience. It's got nothing to do with it. It's our habit of living it again. And actually that makes it stronger and stronger. And it's endemic in our culture. This is what everybody does.
It was really, I don't know, I guess I just had to come to this tonight to get this, because, you know, that was like enlightenment in a brief moment. It was really good. And I think with that awareness, there's really somewhere forward to go. It was really great. So, yeah.
And, of course, with trauma as well, it goes through all the levels. It's there physiologically. Once trauma kicks off in our body, it's there, the adrenaline. You can't undo the adrenaline. You just have to live through it. Once it kicks off in our emotional system, it's there. Mm. We can't fight against it. We have to sit with it, have that courage to name it and sit with it, and then let it pass instead of panic. And then we can start using our wisdom to retrain.
Yeah.
And that's entirely possible. And many people have said post-traumatic stress, you know, it can't be cured, but it actually can be, and it has been. Mm. And the army is at the forefront of this, and a lot of it is cognitive behavior therapy.
Yeah.
But of course, not all sections of the army.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, they're working. I mean, once you didn't even talk about it. So now they talk about it and they've got programs. It's really good. Yeah.
And to know you are not your trauma is the other thing. Mm. It overwhelms you, but you are not your trauma.
Doesn't define us. Yeah.
No. Okay, so it's 8:30. Last, any last questions or comments? Anything at all? Daryl, you're right in the middle of my screen, just nodding the whole time. Is everything all right? How are you going? You're okay? Thank you very much, everyone, for staying back and putting in the extra time. And it's so nice to see your faces and have your feedback. And it's actually kind of see you next week in person or online. Take care. Enjoy what happens, good or bad. You can enjoy it all and use it all.